These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lotte Hulst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you so much for making your way to this series here. Hopefully, if you're not already, you'll become a subscriber as well. Hit that subscribe button, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Acast, wherever you'd like to get your podcast from. And we'll bring you three new interviews every single week, one Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so you can keep up with all of your favorite artists. Discover some new ones and know what's happening in the music world. I'm Kyle Meredith, and today I'm going to be talking with Elliot Easton. Now, Elliot is the guitarist for The Cars, but also part of the supergroup The Empty Hearts, and they have their second record called The Second Album. The Empty Hearts, that's Clem Burke, drummer for Blondie, Elliot from The Cars, Wally Palmer from The Romantics, and Andy Babowick. And we're going to talk all about their record, which is really heavily influenced on the 60s sound that they all grew up with. In fact, there's a lot of Beatles influences, and that just goes further because Ringo Starr is actually a guest on this record, so I am going to be asking about how that came about and the Beatles influences growing up with Beatlemania, and really how, you know, a lot of these artists, they came to attention in the late 70s and early 80s during an era that we would dub as New Wave. Elliot and I are going to talk about how, as it turns out, a lot of those folks, especially the folks that he's playing with here, were always naturally nostalgic. We think about New Wave as a very futuristic sound for the age, but it really had one foot back in their childhood. So we're going to get deep into that one, as well as his objection to the New Wave tag. We'll discuss all the vintage instruments that were used on this, how Elliot says he likes to compose solos. He doesn't wing them. They are composed as if they were a song in themselves. And we'll also be talking about The Cars. You know, it's Panorama's 40th anniversary. And interestingly, Shake It Up, it would be on the next album, but was originally intended to be on that record. So I want to hear the story behind that one. And as far as The Cars, of course, we lost Rico Kasich back in 2019. But up until that moment, there were still plans to possibly make another Cars album. So we'll hear about that as well. So let's get into this and discuss this new album from The Empty Hearts called The Second Album. It's Kyle Meredith with Elliot Easton. How are you?
I'm doing well, as you know, sequestered in with my guitars and music and my Kindle book and binge watching, just trying to make the most of it like everybody else.
That's what we're doing here. Well, The Empty Hearts, you have your second record. It's called The Second Album, a lovely title right there. And it once again finds you guys kind of hitting those 60s musical points that you had in the past. It is such a fun listen. And it's not only, by the way, it's not only the sounds that we're hearing. Like, you're pulling in some new guests here from the 60s. I mean, if you're going to talk about it, you're, of course, going to be talking about the Beatles. You got Ringo Starr on here. What was the story with that?
It's unbelievable. On the first record, my mind was blown that we could get Ian McLagan from the Small Faces and Rod Stewart and the Faces to play keyboards. And on this record, forget it. I mean, it's like the completing of a circle. I was 10 years old when the Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show, February 9th, 1964. And they're almost like a religion to me. I mean, the Beatles are everything to me almost. So it was just unbelievable to get Ringo to play. Like, you know, if you would have told me back then that one day you're going to make a record, you're going to make records anyway, and that one day Ringo from the Beatles is going to play on one, I would have thought, you know, you're crazy. You've got to be kidding me. So all these years later, to have that happen was just a tremendous gift and such a childhood dream and completing kind of a circle, you know, just, wow, what a gift.
What did you do? How did Ringo end up on the record? I mean, what do you just pick up the phone and be like, hey boss, what's going on?
No, it's even funnier than that. We weren't thinking to ourselves, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could get Ringo to play on the record? We had the song, and I think Wally said, or somebody said, man, it really needs that sort of floppy tom-tom Ringo kind of like cool, deep, laid-back groove a little behind the beat with those offbeat kind of like Tom Filsey did. And Wally had played in Ringo's All-Star Band, and I know him socially, and so Wally just called him and asked him because they're friends. And he was working on some other stuff for his new record, and he was in his studio with his assistant. And so it was just in these modern times, a matter of just sending the files to him, and his engineer put it on. He put his headphones on and played his drum set to our song and sent it back. And there's Ringo on drums on our song. Incredible. I grew up in New York. And so, and my high school years were 68 to 71. So I was there, you know, a teenager for some really great, you know, stuff. Yeah, it's nothing like being like first generation, like having experienced some of that stuff in the moment, like Beatlemania, for instance. You know, to be in Long Island when the Beatles were in New York in February 64, it's impossible to explain how exciting that was. The whole city was insane. My whole bus was singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand. Kids, bullies that would usually beat you up, everybody was singing. You can't describe that kind of stuff.
Right.
My first rock concert was Jimi Hendrix opening for the Monkees at Forest Hills. Famous, it's a famous thing. He got booted off the tour. It was right after Monterey, and it was all little girls yelling, Davey, Mickey, and their moms were covering their eyes, and Jimmy was making love to his guitar and doing his act. And that was my first rock concert.
Wow. Jeez, man. No, and that's the thing, because back then, everything was so focused. Obviously, the way we are these days, you have a billion choices, so it's hard for anybody, you know, any one person or a group of people even to get that sort of attention. I mean, even when you look at the biggest pop stars today, it's still not to that level, you know.
I don't know if it's as life-changing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, it meant everything, you know. Yeah. It wasn't a pastime or this or that. It kind of brings around to, like, this Empty Hearts record that we did. Because my concept and the way I expressed it to Andy and the fellas was that when growing up in those high school years, like, music was like a shared experience. And when an important record came out, like the new Beatle album or a new Stones album or some, you know, great new album, it was like a new movie. You know, it was like an event. So, you know, you'd get the record, go over to a friend's house and take off the plastic, and a bunch of guys, friends would be in the guy's bedroom, you know, maybe you'd toke up and puff a little bit, and you'd listen to the whole record from beginning to end without even talking, and you'd read all the liner notes and stare at the cover and try to glean whatever you could from the whole experience. And then afterwards you'd talk about it, like, what'd you think, and it was like a shared wonderful thing. And so my fondest hope for this record was that I wanted to do a record with that sort of White Album variety, Revolver kind of, where it's the record starts you off at point A and drops you off at point B and takes you on a little trip. And even though there's like idiomatically all kinds of different stuff in there, like with the Beatles, there could be a vaudevillian music hall song and then a psychedelic montage like Tomorrow Never Knows, and then a beautiful love song here, there, and everywhere, or whatever it is. And I wanted to do a record that, you know, could do that. You could explore different styles, but it still sounds like you. The way those records, it always sounded like them, even though one song was country and western and one was like backwards tapes.
Right, and it all worked together. So, you know, so when I listen to this Empty Hearts record, that is one of the things I think, because, you know, so this is your all second album. And, you know, when you look at it and you throw the word supergroup in there because of everyone that's involved and from the era that you're all from, which, you know, we're going to categorize because it has been forever of this new wave era. It's the first time that it dawned on me, and I might be saying something that many rock historians have said before, but it's the first time that dawned on me about how nostalgic the new wave bands of that era were already. Like, if you took the synth out, you know, it what you're doing now and a lot of the 60s throwback music with the Empty Hearts isn't so far removed from what you specifically were doing with the Cars. Am I off by that?
You're not off at all. I had the same thought. I had to pick, I'm doing another show next week, and I had to pick some favorites from the Cars and Empty Hearts and some favorite bands that were influenced. And the Cars song I chose was a song that you probably won't even know. It was on Door to Door album, which was the last album proper. And it's a song called Everything You Say. And it's almost like if you took the 80s reverb off of it and brought up the acoustic guitars and the Bakersfield chicken picking Telecaster, it could be like a Gram Parsons song. And it has that vibe. You know, it could be a burrito song or something, or a country rock song. So unlike what you would associate the car as being, like, sleek and streamlined and high tech. But at the core, you're right. I mean, for instance, Best Friend's Girl, obviously a rockabilly lick in the middle of whatever whatever else was going on, or, you know, a rockabilly lick sort of adapted from the Beatles' I Will, fair enough. But, you know, that's part of, like, being good at things is, like, being able to absorb influences and juxtapose them into your own music in a semi-transparent way. Anyway, you don't want to wear it on your sleeve, but you can't help being affected by all the things you love. That's who you are, you know.
Yeah.
So that stuff comes out. But yeah, I mean, I'm a 60s kid. So, you know, when the Cars, I think that's why, like, all those bands that came out when we did, they wanted to dress up in Beatle boots and skinny ties and suits. And they had bands like The Knack and stuff, because they did want to experience that sort of Beatle experience of when they were kids, but they were too young to do that then. So now they're doing it, only it's a different era, and technologically we're carried along into, you know, drum machines and synthesizers and stuff like that, where then we would have hired, you know, a string section,
right,
you know, and a percussionist. So it's a different window dressing, but you're absolutely right. At the heart of it, it's just good old stuff that we all love that we just bring to the table. And that's the, each band, those ingredients of those four or five people is a recipe, and that's what those five sound like, you know.
So I'm going to bridge this into the Empty Hearts, but I would ask about the Cars, like, were you all aware of all of that then? Like it's very natural for any of us, once we especially get into our 20s, to sort of hit that nostalgia point where we start feeding on nostalgia, where we start looking back at the music that we did grow up on 15, 20 years before that, to have those elements incorporated. But again, you were doing something new. You were helping make this new, you know, niche genre of rock while you were at it. But were you aware that it was kind of this reaching into the future and looking back at the same time?
Maybe we were aware of it, but only like standing outside of it, sort of like in a journalistic sense. Like, we were just doing what we do, and we were just carried along in the energy of the time, you know. There was that DIY energy of punk, which that's what wasn't what we were, but there was that kind of energy of just not so much being punk rock, but blowing away some of the pomp of prog and some of the, you know, the endless disco martial beat of boom, 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 and 16th note hi-hats and stuff, and just getting back to like that basic, you know, backbeat, you know, and some rock and roll. And, you know, it's no different. If Chuck Berry had come out in that era, he would have made use of the tools that were available to him then. You can't help it. And so in a way, in a funny kind of way, a genre or a style is almost defined by its limitations, as the parameters of, like, as much as what it isn't as what it is. Like, for instance, you know, rockabilly, you know, you add that fourth chord, no more rockabilly, or right, however you want. You know what I mean? So, like, you have to work within the parameters of that style.
That's interesting that it's so much a, like,
otherwise, it just becomes something else, or it becomes a hyphenated thing.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, we talk about eras and genres, but they really do have to go hand in hand, is a lot about what you're saying. It's what is available in that era that leads to that genre, almost.
I do believe so, because I think any art, as they say, just holds a mirror on what's going on in the world and a mirror on society. And so, you know, look at today's music. It's very violent, very aggressive, and it reflects some, you know. And so music always reflects what's going on. Art, books, movies always reflect what's going on in the world. And I think we were just in the world. But what I think, what is kind of cool about the Cars is that I think I'd like to think anyway, that we've managed to transcend that new wave tag that writers would put on the band just because we came out in 1978. Right. Because, you know, I think the thing that's helped that served our band so well and helped the music endure, and in fact, newer generations of younger people are discovering the band and like it. And I think a big part of that is Rick's poetry, Rick's lyrics. The fact that he explored more of the dark side of the human experience, you know, who's going to hold you down when you shake? I needed someone to bleed, whatever you want. We weren't walking on sunshine, you know what I mean? So, I mean, new wave. I mean, I don't know, new wave. My mom was a Juilliard trained singer. I got my first guitar when I was 3. So I really didn't really care about that new wave thing. And I certainly didn't want to be associated with, like, you had to be out of tune and couldn't play good to have any street cred. I didn't give a damn about that stuff. I just wanted to be a real good musician and make great records.
That you both did both of those, because again, those songs are still standing today. You know, there's not a moment when Drive doesn't come on the radio that I don't stop everything that I'm doing because I want to hear it. There's not a moment when Shake It Up comes on that I don't dance. You know, it's going to happen every single time. I mean, that's the testament of the songs.
I hope to think it never becomes cloying because of the sense of irony that's in the lyrics. Mm-hmm. There's always an edge.
Sure.
You know, there's always a little smirk. And so it's never like, la, 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 you know.
Right. Well, again, tying that to the Empty Hearts here. So here you have a group of friends, again, who all came to prominence around the same time and for similar styles of music, for the tools that you're using at the time. But now you have allowed yourself to lean all the way back. The 60s sound that you do find all of this, is that something that you all, and again, this is the second record, so it's not like the first time we've had, you know, you've had this conversation, but was there a time where you say, this is the band we want to do and this is the sound we want to do because we loved that music? Or is this the ingredients that came when you put it all into the bowl?
Well, it was the progression. With the first album, we were already friends, but we had never been a band before. So that takes time. And so, you know, making your first record is almost like a getting to know you period. And, you know, after making the record together and having rehearsed together and going on the road and traveling and having meals and hanging out and having some laughs, it starts to become a band. And, you know, even though, you know, you think you know people because you've met them over the years, it's a different thing living with them and creating with them and you know, really trying to dig in with somebody and create something. And so, you know, it's a progression. So we as far as a band dynamic, we were tighter as people and tighter musically for the second record. so able to stretch our legs a little bit more and push against those boundaries a little bit and see where the fence was. You know, maybe it's a little further out than we thought on the first record. And so if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so have a little fun with it. It was always in us to do something like that, but I just think it's a progression. And if the first record is a bit more tentative, I think it's only natural just because it's a first record. It wasn't like the Cars where we had the benefit of, like, you know, gigging for a year and that record was our club set. We just recorded it in 12 days. This was like we had to become a band and we all live all over the country and there's logistics. And so to do this thing, one guy's in Rochester, one's in Detroit, two in LA, you know, it's not the same as when we were 23 and, you know, just all in the same town and everything, you know.
Yeah.
So, but definitely, I think we stretched the boundaries on this one. I think we found a little bit more what we can do. And Andy's Fab Gear studio in Rochester is unbelievable. If you're a geek like we are for like that kind of stuff, I don't know if you are, Kyle, but if I tell you that he has mellotrons and sitars.
Absolutely.
And every cool Vox amp and Marshall and Fender and every kind of guitar that the Stones and the Beatles, I mean, he wrote the book Beatles Gear, the Stones Gear book. So talk about like having fun geeking out, dulcimers, every pianos, tack pianos. So we used a lot of those sounds and did a lot more sonically, a lot more ear candy and used some of those instruments for overdubs. And the first record we brought in our friend Ian McLaughlin, may he rest in peace, from the Faces and the Small Faces. And he played the Hammond and the World's a Piano for us. And this time our friend Teddy Andriatis came in and played, who's a wonderful player. And he's played with Guns N' Roses and a lot of different people. And so he put mellotrons and Hammond organ and that stuff. And then we poked around after he left and put some, you know, mellotron things and different keyboards, clavioline, like on Baby You're a Rich Man, that weird oboe sounding instrument.
Right.
Andy has everything, any piece of classic gear. And so it's so much fun, you know,
yeah.
Anything you could think of is, he has it.
It's right there. There's one song that really, I feel you guys stretching out. It's one of my favorites on it. Jonathan Harker's Journal. And this to me, like, you know, I wrote down the Blasters. It kind of reminds me of that. I always call that a bit like desert rock, you know, like you can imagine the Sidewinder skittering across the sand on a
right.
song like that.
Right.
And it's very different from a lot of the other songs on it. And you're so, I think it's you doing the solo, but the solo anyway, every time. Yeah, every time it comes on, I'm going, ah, yes. So tell me about this one, because it stands out. It's different.
Right? That one. So that riff was something Andy came up with. Just this cool little bendy kind of make, almost sounds like a warped record. And I played it. He showed me what he had there. We wrote it as a song and finished, made a song out of it. He had this riff. And I did all the guitars, and Wally played some rhythm on it. And I did all the guitar stuff, all the solos and all the overdubs and stuff like that. So, well, thank you. I'm glad you like it. That's a fun one. It's the thing that all, like, had a little something different. Like, another, like, sort of 180 is Death by Insomnia.
Right, which that it closes out the record, right? And it's, again, that's kind of a heavy thing going on at the end.
For me, it was like a cold turkey Plastic Ono stark harrowing going for.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, 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 boom. Yeah, temperature's rising. And it's that, you know, it aspires to be that. I wrote that one myself. I have to admit, Death by Insomnia. I was going to sing it, but the logistics of where we did the vocals, I couldn't get there. And I'll probably sing it live. But, you know, that's another one that's crazy, you know, Haunting of the Tin Soldier, very, very sort of white album, almost kind of like something like, like Everybody's Got Something to Hide, or like, you know, Glass Onion kind of song. Happiness is a Warm Gun, like those songs that kind of have like change movements. and going to like 3/4, or going to a rock section and stuff. I love all that. I have to admit, I was like really into this like Lenny White album vibe when I was writing for this record. And that's cool. You know, stuff mm-hmm. comes out, you know, the world's gone insane. That was another riff I wrote, just kind of just like a heavy rocking thing. And Clem came up with the title. It was recorded before the world went this insane.
But it did mean something at the time. Like I was going to ask that because
yeah,
like
it was insane enough,
right? Because we can apply it to anything we want on any given day, I think. But I was like, I wonder what specifically set him off that day.
Well, it wasn't that long ago, so I mean, I'm not going to get political, but we thought as crazy as they were going to get. We didn't know the world was going to close,
right?
So it was crazy enough to make that comment because just what was going on. Mm. With things, you know,
politically, it's okay.
current events in the
sure,
world, society right now. But then all this craziness, this pandemic happened, and it's timely. But I'd rather it weren't, you know.
Right. as a lot of songs do go. Yeah. I complimented your solos a minute ago, and you know, I was reading one of your other recent interviews, and what I found really interesting was when you're talking about how you do a solo, you said you don't wing solos, you compose them, going all the way back to the Cars and everything. What do you search for? Because a lot of your solos, you know, there's a strong melody to them. You can sing along to them. My favorite solos are the ones, you know, you turn to your friend who's sitting in the passenger seat and you're both singing the solo as if it were the chorus.
That's right. And that's my goal. It's part of the song. Especially growing up on AM radio in the 60s, and the solos were short, and there was not a wasted note. They were a statement. So what I think about when I'm, my process a little bit, when I'm trying to come up with this stuff is, the first thing I'll think of is my way in, which is to say, I want it to be able to take off after the vocal stops, and take off from the vocal in some kind of cool way, because the solo has to, you know, come in, it can't just come blasting, it has to make sense. Mm-hmm. And have a beginning, a middle, and then an end where it sets back down so the vocal could come in gracefully. And I usually key off the melody of the song, which I think any great soloist from Miles Davis to Eric Clapton to any great soloist, George Harrison, that you want to name, is going to first vibe off the song's melody, because that's the song. And so I'll often use the melody. Like in a song like Shake It Up, I'll play just like the melody for the second half of the solo. I'm actually playing the melody. So I think about the melody a lot. And another thing that I think gives my solos a little bit more of a melodic contour and a little bit different, like separates me, if that's the case, that people tell me my solos are different, is that some of my contemporaries, is that I play through the changes, through the chords, the way a jazz player would. Whereas a typical rock player, if you say, okay, this is a rock solo in the key of A, generally a guitar player will wail away in the key of A, just playing sort of pentatonic blues shapes, mm-hmm. those boxes that we all fall into as a substitute for actual thought when all else fails. You know, everywhere, you have to, you have a library of them. And it's part of the deal. But you know, when you play through the chords and when you move through the changes, it's not static, just staying in that one chord, just playing blues rock. It's moving through the chords like a jazz player would, and it gives it a melody all its own that goes along with the melody that this vocalist is singing, because it's working with the same chords and working with the same chord tones that the singer's using and extrapolating on that. So it like makes sense with the song. And then I'll just, you know, I just want to just, you know, when there are those short pop solos, like I said, I'll figure out my entry, my doorway in, and then where it goes from there, and add till I find the door out. And the whole point of it is that you can walk away whistling it.
Right. Right.
And so when we play concerts, I always play the solos like on the record, mm-hmm. because I know a lot of people think that or feel that like they should play a different solo live. And I always say, well, no, it's part of the song. And like you mentioned, I'd said, like the odds of me winging a better one live than the one that I you know, sweated bullets over are slim to none. And I always think, like, you know, a guy takes his girl and spends almost $1,000 now to go to a concert, have dinner, buy a t-shirt, and you don't play the solo. It's almost disappointing. It's like, it's so satisfying. Like, say you do a song like Touch and Go, and I nail the solo, and they're like, going, he's doing it, he's doing it. And it makes me happy. Like, sometimes they have tears in their eyes. Like, you know, they're so happy. It's just like the record, and they get goose pimples, you know, and I do too. It's a shared thing. So I always think it's like the best to like just nail it like the record, because that shows that you're really going for it, you know?
I like that you brought that up too, with Touch and Go, and you mentioned Shaking Up, different records, but it wasn't until I started reading about the Panorama record, you know, now that it's on its 40th anniversary year, that I had noticed, I'd paid attention finally, that Shake It Up was originally meant for that. And for that record to sound the way it does, again, time, space, where you guys were at, I thought, I wonder if Shake It Up would have sounded differently had it been on that record.
I think there's no question that it would have, but it was that song, and it was that sort of very poppy song, and I think that's maybe why it didn't get on the record. It would have been a different record. I won't mention who, but one, we were very, you know, Rick was very easygoing about songs. He was very prolific, and if we didn't spark off one, he had plenty of others. And, well, okay, well, let's just try something else. Let's get back to that one, maybe another time. No drama. And somebody in the band said, that song sounds sort of pedestrian and ordinary. That was the wording. And first of all, I thought, God, how do you say that to someone who's like just sang you like one of their songs they wrote? Like, just I wanted to crawl. But Rick just said, okay, okay, let's try some others. And so for whatever reason, I always say like a record is like a snapshot of a band at that point in time. It's where you're at those few weeks or months that you make the record. And so that's where we were at in 1980, making that Panorama record. Those were the gadgets we had. Those were the things on our mind. Those were the songs Rick were writing. Those were the amps I was using. You know, that's the food we eat in that year. You know, and so the next album is something different. It's 2 years later, and we're 2 years older and 2 years more experiences.
That one, I know, is Panorama is kind of the great overlooked album sometimes when you stack it up to some of the bigger records and everything, but I love that it's getting so much attention right now. It's been a long time coming. It's a great record.
It's a funny, it's cool. I'm glad, you know, I mean, we never thought it was like a particularly obscure, and we certainly never said this is going to be more experimental or we're going to go further out with the record or anything. Honest to goodness, it was really just where we were at. Mm-hmm. We were just reacting to Rick's latest batch of songs. And those were the songs he was writing then. That was the songs. So, you know, I mean, you never know. And then, like, the first record and Candia were really successful records and sold many, many records. And Panorama did well, but didn't instantly out of the box go like multi platinum like the others. And so people thought, oh, it was a little more edgy or something. I don't know. It wasn't in my mind at the time. It was just, I guess, you know, not to intellectualize this stuff, but anytime a record is huge, you know, or anything, it's about capturing the zeitgeist and capturing the public's imagination at that moment in time with what they want at that moment. So I for the first two records, the public, they were really, that was really a lot of people wanted. I don't know how else to explain this stuff.
Sure.
Otherwise, every record you make would be a hit.
Yeah, well, it's still a damn fine record. And I'll say that, by the way, about the final Cars record that came out just a few years ago. You know, at WFPK here in Louisville, like, we still play Sad Song. We still play Keep on Knocking. You know, I think we still play Free. This was a really good record, too. And I don't know, was it meant to be the final chapter, or did you guys think that there was going to be another Cars record down the road beyond that one?
The door wasn't closed on it. We never like had specific conversations, but after the week we spent together at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, there was a lot of like nice bonding, and we spent a week rehearsing and again becoming a band again.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And it was bittersweet, of course, without Benjamin there. But again, the old humor comes back. Every band has their own sort of code and language and inside jokes and all that comes back. And it's just like you never left. And so we left on a very, very good note, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And the door was not closed on the possibility of doing more work, the four of us, but now.
It's a hell of a legacy, the entire catalog. And it's been so much fun watching what everyone had done beyond that, yourself included. I know the Empty Hearts, it's not your first supergroup beyond the Cars. It seemed like you've done some fun collaborating. Pandemic aside, do you have any more of those in the works? What comes next for you?
Well, what comes next is to get out and play. I'm writing and I'm playing every day, and you're going to do that anyway because it's just what you love to do. But what's next is what we were going to do before we were so rudely interrupted. For instance, the record came out August 28th. Well, we had the Whiskey Go-Go in Hollywood booked, and we were going to have this great record release party and all these cool people and Rodney, and everyone was going to come and have a great time and play and take off on the road and start playing and getting this music in front of people, which, as you know, even in the old days, you had to play. You couldn't just throw a record out there.
Right.
A few people, Steely Dan, a few people didn't tour. Harry Nilsson, a few people didn't tour. You know who they were. But for the most part, you had to get out there and promote a record. It's kind of flip-flop now where a record is more of an excuse to tour because nobody buys records and musicians make the bulk of their income from live performance. But the point being is that that's certainly foremost in our minds as far as coming up next is we really would like to get out there and play.
Man, seeing you guys, I know I'll be there. When it ever happens, I'm going to be there.
You'll be welcome.
Elliot, it has been such a pleasure and an honor to talk to you about all this. Congratulations on the second album from the Empty Hearts. I'm glad you guys called it the second album. That makes it really easy for us anyway. It's not a Traveling Wilburys type of thing, It's
it wasn't my choice, but I think it's pretty funny.
but it is such a fun listen, front to back, all the way. So congratulations on that. And thank
that's
you so,
so
much.
Great. I'm so glad you enjoy it. And that's the spirit that it was intended to just dig it from front to back. I'm so glad you're enjoying it. Well, thank you for asking good questions.
Yeah, I appreciate that too, man. Take care out there, and I guess we'll see you when we see you.
Looking forward to it, man, as soon as we can.
All right, man.
Come and say hi.
Will do, absolutely. I'll see you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
My thanks to Elliot Easton. Again, the brand new Empty Hearts record is called The Second Album, 40th Anniversary of the Cars Panorama. Might as well give that one another spin as well. Thanks to you for checking out the episode before you get out. Again, I do hope you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now. You can get us at all the major podcast hotspots like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Acast, wherever you like to get your podcasts from. In fact, the YouTube version of this is the video version, so you can check that out if you want to see this interview as well. And then after all of that, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. That's an hour full of song premieres and music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of them at Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org, from Louisville Public Media.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.